Okay, my name is John Bayliss. I'm from Westpac Institutional Bank in the equities team. I'm running a risk team there, and I'm a member of the RMPC. The session today is about creating and setting up a risk appetite for businesses, and this is much more of a business focus response, if you like, to the APRA session run by Ian Loughlin on the first morning, if you can all remember that far back. So I'm just going to briefly introduce my colleagues on the RMPC, which is convened by Kent Griffin, the gentleman in the middle. I'm not going to read out his entire CV because that would probably take the entire session, but just a few highlights. He's currently a partner at Ernst & Young. Previously a CRO and CFO of various parts of AXA across Asia and probably France before that. And I heard through the grapevine he's a tractor pimper. So maybe if you get a chance to talk to Kent about that, you'll find out a lot more about what that means. Kent's going to speak, I think, for about 20 minutes or so. Kent?
Yes.
About the practical aspects of setting and working with risk appetites, and he's joined at the podium by John Evans, who's head of enterprise risk advisory at CBA, and also Mike Thornton, who's chief actuary and CRO at AXA prior to the merger with AMP. Both of these guys are into soccer and real ale, I think, which is men after my own heart. Mike also tells me he's a unicycler and juggler. So, again, hopefully we'll get some of that going on in the AXA deal.
So,
yeah. Without further ado, I'll pass on to Kent.
Can everyone hear me? Yeah. Good morning. Thank you for that introduction. First of all, my apologies. I'm actually feeling a little under the weather, not because of the dinner last night, but I'm still recovering from a little bit of flu. So if my voice suddenly starts to fail me or if I seem to go to the side with some coughing, please forgive me in advance. Okay, so the topic of risk appetite is starting to get a little more airplay in Australia, thanks to APRA, in the last few months. And so, as John mentioned, the purpose of this session was really to put up some ideas and thoughts to get us all thinking, and then really to have a discussion about practices in this area that are existing, and then what people are potentially working on, and share some experiences. I'll start today with a quote, not the same one up on the board, something I was reading a few months ago, where the quote was, "Designing risk management without defining risk appetite is like designing a bridge without knowing the river it spans. Your bridge will either be too long or too short, too high or too low, and certainly not the best solution to cross the river." In other words, when we talk about risk appetite, we're really saying that in the context of risk management, if you don't know what your objectives are of what you're trying to do, you're really jumping in to design a framework without knowing what it's trying to achieve. Part of what I'll touch on today is the link of risk appetite into various parts of the business, including strategy. And this comes through when you read a lot of the materials and see what people are doing in risk appetite. There's a couple of things that become apparent. One is the importance to tie risk appetite in with the strategy and the plans of an organisation. And secondly is how you then take that risk appetite and actually make it work in practice. And as I'll talk about, that's where the real challenge comes. Now, part of the problem with putting together this deck, I actually put this deck together for a similar version of this for a webinar a few months ago, and I thought, great, I'll give a couple of examples of why it's topical at the moment. One of those was APRA, and I mentioned, Ian's not in the room, is he? I mentioned to Ian that every time I go and write, well, I mentioned this to him yesterday, every time I go to use this deck, he gets up and makes a speech somewhere and says something else, and so I have to go and rewrite the slide. So I've given up at this point. So a number of you may have heard Ian talk earlier in the convention. This was an extract from some of the comments that Ian made actually late last year. In terms of the FSC conference that was a week or so ago, I mean, he made comments again. I'll just read you out a couple because I think they're very relevant to set the context. He said, "A well-considered, clearly articulated risk appetite is the very foundation of sound risk management. Without this, risk management throughout the business will be carried out on uncertain foundations with unclear expectations. In summary, we found," this is APRA, "a range of issues, including no clear..." This was in response to some work they've done looking at what practices in Australia. "In summary, we found a range of issues, including no clear statement of risk appetite or no obvious understanding of what it is actually is in concept. Statements ranging in quality from poor to quite good, and a lack of analysis using stress testing." And anyone who was in the session during the convention earlier knows that Ian is actually, as indicated on a number of occasions, APRA is working on guidance in this area at the moment. They've already given a checklist to their supervisory teams that go out, and we'll obviously be seeing more from them. And so very clearly, in a number of contexts, if only in the roles that actuaries play in financial services, but certainly where you have actuaries involved in doing financial condition reports and commenting on LPS 220, GPS 220, etc., this is going to become an area where we're going to have to very clearly have a view on how we respond and make comment on a company's risk appetite. I won't go through this next slide was further indication of what Ian was saying. I also wanted to, a second example that when I put this deck together, just to give you an idea of some of the catalysts for risk appetite, I'm sure many people in the room will have had various experience with Solvency II. I have in a former role over the last few years. One of the things that struck me about, and hopefully this is shared for those in the room who've worked in Solvency II type aspects. Solvency II is much more than a way of calculating capital. When you're actually sort of living and breathing it and trying to put it in place for an organisation, it is very much about integrating risk appetite and risk management into the organisation. So when you're looking at whether you have an effective organisation under Solvency II, the actual reserving piece, not to say it's not important, it's important and it's got a lot of complications to it, but there's a very big piece of it, which is how you actually then take that, use it, operationalise it, and get the organisation to understand what the implications are of the risk actions it's taking. Now, this is a particular example of KEOPS where they're the advice for level 2 implementation. Again, I'm not going to go through in the detail. It's in the slides. If you want to read it, you can access it online. But again, it talks about a clearly defined and well-documented risk management strategy that includes risk management objectives, key risk management principles, general risk appetite, and assignment of risk management responsibilities. Again, bringing through that theme of there's no point actually doing risk management if you don't know what you're trying to do, if you don't know what your objectives are. So just starting with an obvious statement, risk-taking is part and parcel of business, as we know. We're not, when we're doing risk management, it's an obvious statement now, we've heard it many times, we're not out to avoid risk, we're out to look at how we optimise risk. And certainly in risk appetite and the way it ties into strategy, that's very much the case. It's all about what risks to take, which ones are we going to get rewarded for, and which ones are going to potentially hurt us in the current circumstances. And for that reason, and you'll hear me belabor this point over and over again, you really can't differentiate it from strategy. When you start at at a board level within an organisation and you start talking about strategy and decisions that are going to be made, initiatives, projects, etc., each one of them inherently has risk, and it goes to your risk appetite. It's interesting sometimes talking to people about this topic and developing risk appetite, because there is this idea that if you have an organisation and you're putting together a policy statement, and you'll see some examples in a moment, of what risk appetite, of how you state it, that somehow going through some exercise to do risk appetite will currently create, will create risk appetite. It doesn't. Every organisation at this moment has a risk appetite, regardless of whether they've got a risk appetite statement, regardless of whether they've got a risk management framework. They already have it. Now, how does that risk appetite play out in practice? On the one hand, it can simply be the decisions that individuals make every day in executive committees through down through to operational levels without any real understanding of what each other is doing. That's still a risk appetite. It's born out of the practices the individuals do. A lot of this discussion around risk appetite is taking that behaviour and those activities and building around it a framework so you get a consistent application amongst all those decisions. Another point just to draw out on this slide is I'll go through in a moment the process that at least seen some organisations adopt in sort of thinking this through. But one of the things that is the challenge is at a board level or at a senior management level, you tend to deal with very high-level KPIs in risk management. That's just a reality. Once you get within an organisation, you work down through the functions and the different areas, distribution, marketing, product, and IT and all those, you will end up with a whole range of different areas and different KPIs that you're focused on. In a former life, when looking at the sort of KPIs, we used to have a board-level dashboard, as we called it, and then we used to have functional-level dashboards. Now, if you added up all the functional-level dashboards of all the things that everybody looked at across the entire organisation, you were probably looking at a book that rivaled War and Peace on a monthly basis. Probably people here like War and Peace, but gave me as much of a headache reading War and Peace as it did reading the dashboard. But once you actually see that distilled at a board level, you're much more likely to be down to half a dozen or a dozen pages tops, where people are trying to get an overview of what's material at the high level. And this journey of trying to work from a sort of top-down level to a bottom-up level is really the key challenge of risk appetite. At a board level, you'll tend to have discussions around what's my potential impact on earnings? What's my potential impact on capital? How likely I'll go insolvent next year? Can I pay a dividend? Those are the sort of issues. Whereas if you get down to an IT department, for example, you'll be talking about tolerances around outages. You'll be talking around response times to customers if you're in customer service. And drawing that link is really the challenge. This is a little bit of a framework. I'm with Ernst & Young, so I've borrowed this from Ernst & Young. It's not my own work. But I just, and this is one framework, and there's a lot of frameworks out there. If you go on the internet, you'll find half a dozen. But one approach to actually starting to work through what your organisation's current risk appetite is, let alone what you'd like it to be, is to go through a series of steps. The first is to understand what is the capacity for risk within your organisation. Now, that sometimes the easiest way to think of that might be how much capital do I have, because clearly the more risk I take, the more capital I'm going to require. But it is a lot broader than that. Is what is my ability to actually take risk? How strong is my balance sheet? How strong is my franchise? How strong is my earnings profile? And those sort of things will define capacity. From there, you actually do get straight to risk appetite. And it is simply, what am I willing to take? What are the things I'm willing to do? What are the things I'm willing to risk? I'll repeat this in a little while, but just to put some colour around that, walking into a boardroom and putting a blank piece of paper there and saying to a board, what's your risk appetite? Get some interesting responses, but usually it's articulated around the sort of things the board see. So usually it's a conversation around, well, we're very focused on earnings. Why are we focused on earnings? Because the market's focused on earnings, because it affects shareholder value. So what's all the things that it could impact our earnings? Similarly, we get visits from the regulator. So they're going to get worried if we don't have enough capital. So what's all the things that can drive our capital, and what's the things we would do or wouldn't do that can impact that capital? So that sort of discussion, which sort of frames at a higher level where you want to be. From there, it sort of starts to move through risk tolerances, targets, and limits. Now, there's a bunch of definitions up there, but probably the easiest way I can describe this is it's very analogous to what we do on the performance side. If you walked into an there are organisations that do this, but if you walked into an organisation and said and looked at their monthly earnings reporting and said, okay, earnings are $100 this month. If that was all I told you, you'd probably look at me rather quizzically. You'd say, well, that's great, but what did you expect? Did you want 200 in earnings? Did you want 50 in earnings? What was your budget for earnings? The metrics you look at only work in the context of what you're actually expecting, what you're actually planning. And there's absolutely no different for risk. To sit there in an organisation and look at your risk reporting metrics, whatever they are, and basically say, well, you know, I've got target surplus of X million. So what is that the amount I need? Do I need more than that? Do I need less than that? And you can say that for all the risk metrics. So in the same way that when you do plans and budgeting and performance that we're all used to in companies, and you take those and you turn them into budgets, tolerances, limits, all the rest of it that go out through your organisation to influence how you want to perform, there's a very, very analogous structure within risk that you can undertake. Again, just borrowing from EY, this slide. This sort of takes that same structure and just tries to put it in the context of where it might fit within an organisation. So just working down the left-hand side, again, risk capacity. As I said, that's often framed in terms of capital. How much risk can I take? Risk appetite, so again, a very strategic level discussion, as I've said. Risk tolerance, just to flesh this out a bit, will then start to get into certain areas. So you'll get into functional areas of compliance, operations. So a classic here I mentioned earlier is in IT. I had the fortune, I think I'll call it fortune, to be involved with IT for a couple of years in a former life. And one of the hardest things I found, well, not one of the hardest, but certainly one of the hardest things in that was to understand, when you actually look within how IT works, how you actually link that back to something like risk appetite. So there's some obvious things you can do, like, you know, if all the systems go down for the next 2 weeks and you've got customers screaming at you, then quite clearly you can put some tolerances around outages and things like that. But more generally, when you go down to systems and look at, you know, level of complexity, ease of maintenance, life cycles, redundancies, all that sort of stuff, that's all the good stuff in IT. It actually suddenly becomes a real challenge. How do I actually relate this back to what I'm talking to my board about? Because it's not actually the conversation you normally have at a board level. Risk targets. This can be, again, you're putting targets around. The obvious example of this where we do it is for actuaries is in target surplus. Classic example of this. So we take a view that we don't want to just hold regulatory capital. Because in the end, day-to-day volatility could mean we're above it as much as we're below it, and that would be a little awkward in dealing with regulators. So we pitch a level of target surplus. Now, notwithstanding the very informed discussion you have with regulators on where they think you should pitch it, there's also an internal discussion on balancing off the cost of holding that additional capital on an ongoing basis, because fairly much you're locking it in, versus, you know, how can I respond to that that situation of day-to-day movement, and how often do I want to be suddenly scrambling around seeing if I can shore up my capital because I've run a thin level of target surplus? That's a classic example of a target, and there's many more. And finally, you get risk limits. Now, this is when you really start getting into the the sort of nitty-gritty of the functional areas in an organisation, and you'll have everything from financial to operational risk limits around what you can do. Again, to try to put something around this, some colour around it, if you're doing work on your asset portfolios, you're running general account business, and you're looking at how you do asset mixes, one of the risk limits that'll normally be on there is duration and convexity for how you're actually managing your investment portfolios. Sitting inside an investment committee, listening to how they talk about setting duration and convexity limits is often a far cry from sitting in the boardroom and trying to understand how the board's perceiving the impact of what's being done in that investment committee. So again, you get a lot of different areas in the business focused on setting these limits. As I mentioned, War and Peace earlier, if you put them all together in a document, you get a lot of them. Question comes, how do they relate back to the overall risk appetite? I'm not doing well with that button, am I? 5 minutes? Okay, all right. Main point I want to make on this slide is, as I've said over and over again already, hard part is linking high-level risk appetite to operational statements. There's a number of ways this is done in practice. I've seen organisations who build quite complex aggregate models, some of them across countries, and try to build in as many different risks as they can to create a quantifiable link from sort of a high level down into the operational. And look, that sounds really good in theory. Wearing an advisory hat, it's a great project because you can do it for years and you can build huge models, and it's, you know, no, it's not actually a great advisory project. Because frankly, very quickly what you find is the level of risk within an organisation and the level of exposures is so great that it is a little bit of a fallacy, at least in my view, to try to think you can capture that in a modelling exercise. The model itself becomes more of a focus than actually managing the risk. This is where it is going to be interesting to see how this discussion evolves in the next 12 months with whatever APRA puts out, because I do believe, and this is a personal opinion, that there is only so far you can go in creating very strong quantitative links between a high-level risk appetite and what promulgates throughout the organisation in terms of tolerances and budgets and limits. There is an element of the qualitative that has to go in there, and not losing sight of the fact that what you actually want is responsible risk management, not just to build yourself a very complex model. I can put these back up later. I mean, this was partly to get some of our thinking going in terms of what a risk appetite statement might look like. At a high level, these are all examples that either I've come across or some of my colleagues at EY have come across in how things might be stated in terms of a risk appetite statement. There are some companies in Australia that you can go to their websites, at least one of the banks from memory, that actually has something like this sitting on their website. And certainly globally, if you go into Europe or US, you'll see companies with these sort of statements. Again, at a high level, it's about focusing on usually some sort of quantitative, often probabilistic statement about how something might move. What's the chance I can't pay a dividend next year? What's the chance I'm going to actually breach my regulatory capital? Is it a 1 in 5, 10, 20, 100-year event? Those sort of statements. And generally, they're around earnings, capital, value, dividend payment, and sometimes around rating agencies, around ratings, etc. There's also a series of qualitative risk statements which come into the process, and these can be much more around things like reputational risks, so and other areas where it's less open to being sort of clarified on a quantitative basis, but you still want to make statements around it. One of the interesting things I'll draw out in this is when you start to look at some of these statements, I think there's one on the next slide, you do see organisations put up absolute statements. One example that's in one of the slides is, you know, we have no tolerance for fraud. We will not have a fraud event. Now, that's what I call an aspirational statement. It's not actually a risk tolerance statement. The amount that I'm not sure if you ever could guarantee that you could never have a fraud event, but even if you wanted to try, the level of cost that would involve would be huge. So by its nature, there is a first exercise sometimes with boards to get them across the absolute statement into the relative. At the end of the day, I'm only going to be able to... There's always a chance something will happen. I'm only going to be able to put in place a risk management framework that deals with it at a certain level of confidence. Question is, how far do I go relative to how much confidence I actually want? This is some more examples and some statements you might just want to flick through. I think the absolute statement I was going to mention is on there. We're aware of time. It wouldn't be an actuarial convention if I didn't throw up a actuarial control cycle. This time it's the risk appetite life cycle. This is simply just a reminder. It's a fairly obvious one. Risk management is an ongoing process. Risk appetite, I believe, is not actually something you do once every 5 years or once every 3 years. It is an ongoing thing that evolves with an organisation, and it can evolve or change incredibly quickly. One of the sessions, I used the example yesterday of the experience during the GFC. Within the space of a couple of months, the appetite for risk around liquidity, the appetite for risk around asset exposures, etc., for most insurers around the globe changed fundamentally, and triggered actions which were quite significant. That it changed in two ways. It changed, one, recognising that the environment itself had changed, i.e., we went from being able to get cash to not being able to get it readily. And the second thing is it changed relative to your peers in the industry. So it's not just where you're sitting in terms of whether financial condition or some other aspect, but where your peers are sitting. If you're in the group, in the group of what's happening in the industry, it's a different potentially risk appetite to if you're sitting out there alone. And again, that's the sort of thing that continually comes back into revisiting where risk appetite is and how you cascade that through the organisation. So look, just in summary, risk appetite is fundamental to risk management. I hope I've got that point across. There is going to be some developments on this in the Australian environment, if nothing else, because it'll be driven from a regulatory perspective. But certainly, it's not a clear-cut area where, you know, it's a matter of just going out and building a model. It can be a highly subjective exercise, particularly linking what you do at a strategic level into what you operationalise. It is, in my view, fundamental to what actuaries do. I have a strong part of being on the Risk Management Practice Committee is I have a strong belief that actuaries are significant players in the risk management industry, whether it be through being subject matter experts or broader in terms of CRO-type roles and everything in between. Unless we're giving clear indications to our companies and our clients of what we think their objectives are and the context to how they're doing their risk management frameworks, then really we're not building that bridge correctly, as I mentioned at the outset. I'm going to stop my comments there and hopefully look forward to hearing comments and discussions. Thank you.
Thanks, Kent. Kent asked me to just talk very briefly around some of the practical problems associated with implementing this, and you'll see some recurring themes in the comments I'm about to make. I just want to reinforce Kent's point on the importance of this, and then I'll talk around three practical difficulties. Those are the need for an iterative discussion with the board, the difficulty in making risk appetite operate at both an organisational level and an operational level, and finally the difficulty in determining the points at which you need to de-risk. So firstly, just reinforcing Kent's point on importance. On the one hand, everybody in this room, maybe with a few exceptions, came through the financial crisis reasonably unscathed, and we did quite well in Australia. So you might question, why do we need this? But on the other hand, we can all name companies who failed or needed to be bailed out. on many occasions, largely because they had risks that, whilst appearing remote, were actually big enough to compromise their businesses. And those are the failures we know about. I also suspect there was a whole raft of issues going on in a whole raft of organisations that never caught the headlines. And so I think there are a whole host of similar issues that everybody faced. So having a well-understood risk appetite statement and checking your organisation is actually operating in a manner that is consistent with that is very important. And I think without it, it's very hard to put your hand on your heart and say you've got a really good handle on your risk profile and that you're really going to be well-placed to react to events in a timely manner. So be in no doubt, this is important. On to the practical issues, the first related to the need for an iterative discussion with the board. The board needs to own both qualitative and quantitative risks. And because we're looking at the risk profile of the organisation in a different way, directors may well have different views on risks they're comfortable with and uncomfortable with. And similarly, we could find risks in our business already that are a surprise to directors. And that could lead to quite difficult discussions around what they're comfortable with and not comfortable with. So be prepared for an iterative discussion, and you're going to need to ensure that your board understand that the risk appetite framework and statement is going to take some time to evolve. The second practical issue relates to making this useful at an operational level. You don't want to go to your board telling them that we're now exceeding our risk appetite without knowing which part of the business has changed and what your proposal is regarding de-risking. Instead, what you want to happen is that your exposures are consistently monitored on a regular basis in your businesses, and as those exposures are changing, they're being proactively managed within the business before they become issues at an organisational level. And this is where risk appetite has a huge amount of value. But getting this to operate consistently right across your business is a significant modelling challenge. Kent talked about this. Great business for consultants building economic capital models across countries and covering all risks. But actually giving the first line of defence the tools to be able to think about their exposures and manage those in real time is a significant challenge. Finally, I just want to touch on the difficulty of determining the points at which you need to de-risk. At AXA, we sought to use a traffic light colour-coded system to monitor our exposures. And this leads to three levels of exposure that we monitored. So there's a green comfort zone where we're happy with the exposures we have. And we've got an amber alert zone. So in this area, the risk is increasing. We need to escalate the risk through our governance structure and make some conscious decisions around whether we're happy with those higher risks or whether we want to start de-risking. And finally, a red de-risk zone where de-risking must occur. There's not going to be any debate around whether it occurs or not. Now, Kent alluded to this, that things can change very, very quickly. Your capacity for risk can change, and that definitely happened during the financial crisis. Excess assets and capital in businesses fell, and at the same time, risks were escalating, not least because markets were falling and volatility was rising. So risks that previously may well have been tracking green on our traffic light system became red quite quickly, and that can lead to you de-risking at the worst possible bloody point in the cycle. So you're selling assets when asset values are low, or you're in a position where you're buying insurance when it's very expensive. And so these are determining that point at where your risks change from amber to red is crucially important and very hard to do. But it's important that you do it now. You don't want to be procrastinating now and then struggling to make a decision when it's too late. So look, those are just three practical issues I'd highlight. This is a very important area. It's a very difficult area for sure. But as actuaries, we've all got an important role to play in helping companies think through these issues. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Excuse me. I'm going to similarly share with you some of the experience that we've had at CBA in developing a risk appetite statement with the board. I've worked very closely with the group CRO over the last 2 years in taking it sort of from concept through to what we think is a pretty effective and useful concept that runs through the group and is reasonably well embedded. Always still more to do, of course, but these are some of the things that really we had to get sorted out in order to get, you know, through that journey. So the first one really is all about understanding what you mean by risk appetite. And people who have heard me speak before will know I bang on about this a lot. But it is absolutely crucial that you have a common understanding through the group of what risk appetite is. Kent talked about the differences there about capacity, willingness, etc., to take on risk. What I found in conversations around the bank when I first started was there was very different views as to what appetite meant, and therefore there were some very confusing conversations. There had been attempts previously to establish a risk appetite, but they'd kind of foundered, and I think part of that was because people were actually talking about completely different things. So we've agreed within the group that risk appetite is effectively the willingness to take on risk rather than the capacity to take on risk, or rather than the target level of risk, or in fact the actual level of risk we're running. They're different, they're all part of the framework, but risk appetite is a boundary on our risk-taking activities. It defines that outer limit in which the business can go and play to their heart's content as long as they don't go outside that boundary. And if you think about the dual role of risk management, as always we do in the bank, between protection of the bank and advising our business partners in terms of getting optimum risk return, risk appetite is very much of the former. It's the protection piece. The second piece is for risk management. The second challenge is then to work with the business to optimise risks and returns within that outer boundary. The second thing is obviously getting board engagement. And we were very aware from the start that going to the board and saying, here's a risk appetite statement, what do you think, was probably not going to get engagement, ownership, which is what you need to get. And certainly what, if you listen to Ian Loughlin, you'll hear him talk about the need for ownership. So APRA and the regulators definitely want to see ownership of risk appetite. So we knew we were going to have to take the board along with us through the sort of development journey. We found the best way of doing that was not to actually mention risk appetite at all, but just to go and have a structured conversation with them around their views on stuff, which is how it starts out. And in those conversations, you ask some questions and you get them to say what they're comfortable with, what they're not comfortable with, rank some things. You know, talk about absolute measures, talk about relativities. And we were very, you know, you need to find a way basically of getting that set of views from the board. You want to get everyone's view. The technique we used was to actually get people to anonymously give us their answers. So everyone had their view and they weren't sort of outed for their view. But where there was a disconnect or a range of views amongst the board members, then we had a conversation around that and said, okay, you know, if you're aligned, great. If you're not, well, we need to work that out because you're pulling this way and you guys are pulling this way. So finding a mechanism to do that is really important. And as Mike said, you know, it's not going to be a single conversation where you go in and the risk appetite's established and we're all done and dusted. It's a series of conversations. We did it over 4 consecutive board sessions, so over 4 months. And then, of course, you do get to the stage where you draft a document, and then, of course, it gets into, I don't like that word, and I don't like that word. But, you know, it's really important that you have the conversation before you get into that wordsmithing stage, because that inevitably will come. The third thing I wanted to mention was the link to strategy, which, again, Kent has talked about. Appetite and strategy have to go hand in hand. And what you don't want is a disconnect between the two, where the board might be approving a strategy without being aware that that's taking them outside the appetite that they've already expressed, or in fact they haven't expressed in some cases. So getting that connection, and one of the big successes we've had is actually incorporating risk appetite and the annual review of risk appetite into the strategic planning process. So the first question when a business unit comes to the board and says, this is my strategy, is, well, is this within the existing appetite that we've approved? Yes, great, okay, now tell me why it's good. But the conversation also can be, no, it isn't. And that's equally valid, but there might be great business reasons to why we want to go there. But what we want is transparency in that debate, not that we suddenly go, ah, actually, we just realised we've got an exposure out here which is outside appetite because you approved a strategy which we didn't talk about in the context of risk appetite. So joining those two up is really important, and you won't really get success, I don't think, without having them happening in the same conversation. The last point I wanted to make was just around culture. People talk a lot about risk culture, and risk culture is central to all of this. Risk appetite goes a long way to influencing culture. It gives people principles which can underpin any day-to-day business decisions they're making. But of course, culture is a very slow thing to change. So it's making sure that ownership of risk is in the right place and that people are incentivized to take the risk behaviors that you want them to take. So getting things like risk-adjusted profit as a key metric into your KPIs is obviously going to have a better risk result for you than one where you just reward on profits. So those are four things that we've had to address, and I think addressed reasonably successfully, which I think, you know, in any framework that you're trying to roll out, you really need to be very cognizant of.
Okay, thanks, guys. Lots of provocative comments there, and hopefully that's raised lots of questions in all your minds. So I'd like to encourage you to raise those questions, come up to the mics, state your name, as ever these sessions are recorded. And just a reminder to fill out the forms. This is your last chance to do one of these in a concurrent session, so do that before you leave, please. Thanks.
Caroline Bailey's Commonshaw. I was very interested in your comments there, John, about cultural change. And I just wondered if... I just wondered if everybody had... And Mike, you mentioned consistent application of the risk appetite. I just wondered if there are any other observations about changing culture right down to the front line. Mm-hmm. Not just...
Well, as I said, you know, culture is central to all of this. I think shifting culture is difficult, and I think there's some really fundamental things you do need to get right. So ownership of risk is really important, and I think one of the things that we've succeeded in particularly is changing the focus from risk management owns risk to the business owns risk. And that really wasn't seen as the business's responsibility. You know, they were very much of the view that we do business and the risks that drop out of it are their own by risk management. So getting that cultural shift is important and also can be quite difficult. The way that we think we've achieved that quite successfully is to actually put the onus on developing lower level risk appetites for each business unit onto the business unit head with the support of their chief risk officer, but not led by or owned by the chief risk officer. So therefore, the conversation that we would expect and we know happens in the business units to sort of greater and lesser extent, some work better than others, is that it's a conversation with management about what do you want to achieve and what are you not prepared to accept in achieving that. And that gets you to set your target and also your appetite limit. Because if you actually go and talk about the limit straight away, they go, well, I don't know what my limit is. I just know I want to grow my book by 10%. And then you get to the point of saying, well, okay, and it's on a scale, it's on a spectrum of this is your target, this is your appetite. They're kind of different points on the same curve. And I think getting those sorts of conversations shifts the ownership, and that is the really big cultural change that we've achieved.
Yeah, much. I mean, agree with everything you said, John. I mean, I think also there's you can't get away from the role of leadership when it comes to getting the cultural change. One, as John was talking, one of the examples that comes to mind in a former life is the organisation I'm thinking of was launching a product in another country other than Australia. The particular product was a 25-year trauma product, I think, with guarantees. All sorts of guarantees in it around what coverages there'd be and all this sort of thing. And two things I noticed in that example. I mean, when that came up, there was a lot of business pressure to do it. And the then CEO of that particular operation sort of stopped and said, no, look, we've got to look at this in terms of a risk. I absolutely understand why we want to do it, but we also need to look at the risk side of it and how these guarantees could play out in 5, 10, 15 years, 20 years. So first of all, that sort of walking the talk by the leadership is to me a first step in actually creating the culture. Second statement I'll make might be a bit provocative, is the more senior you get in organisations, sometimes you find people with maybe bigger egos. Anyone who wants to take me to task on that, please do. But look, one of the interesting things out of that is risk appetite is... about, we talked about, you know, use words like communication and everything else. Risk appetite's as much about just having a shared understanding across an organisation of what your boundaries on risk are. I made a comment somewhere in the presentation. Organisations have risk appetites all the time. It's just a question of whether are they a collection of individual risk appetites acting individually, or are they actually a shared understanding of whatever my individual preference for risk might be. The organisation itself has a preference for risk, and I understand that. So therefore, coming back to my little comment about egos, the more senior you get in an organisation, leaders can act in two ways. They can sit there and say, I'm comfortable with this risk because I'm the leader of this organisation or whatever, or they can sit back and they can say, I work as part of an organisation. As an organisation, we have this view on risk, and therefore... that's how we should apply it. Now, maybe I'm being too subtle on the difference, but I think it's really important. In that example that I was mentioning on the trauma insurance, the person in question actually went back and said, all right, what's the potential implications of this? You know, I think, if I remember the example correctly, it was, you know, what would do this do to our capital? How could it move our earnings? There was a couple of other things that they raised. What would the stress test look like? And then how does this sit in the context of the sort of strategy we've discussed with the board in the past? That was the sort of conversation we had. And to me, that was very strong leadership, because it wasn't just an individual sitting down saying, hey, I'm happy with doing this product or not happy with doing this product, but it was about linking it back. And that sent, you know, very clear signals to the organisation of, we do want to have a shared of understanding. And that, to me, did, you know, much more in terms of creating a common risk culture, that sort of behaviour, than all the policies and governance structures and everything else we could have put in place, which would have taken a lot longer.
Jenny Lyon. Talking about that whole embedding it in the culture, and in your presentation yesterday, Kent, you talked about the people being really important and gave us an example there. So at what point do you think it's important to engage HR in the conversation? Because often it seems to me, particularly say in a crisis, suddenly training goes, people go, we're focusing on the numbers, whereas actually perhaps that's when they really should be focusing on what we need to do so that when we get into a crisis we can, you know, react appropriately. So where do you see HR in the process, and at what sort of level, I guess, do you bring them in? Thanks.
I'll start off on the comments. I'm probably biased on this. I had a former experience where I I saw an organisation do risk management and risk appetite, and HR was at the table right from the start. And I was very impressed by that. Now, that, by the way, that involved two things. One, the leadership of the organisation very clearly understood that risk management only works if you've got people that can actually execute it on a daily basis. It's about understanding where we want to be and then making decisions on that. Now, the framework doesn't do that. It's just an enabler. The other side of that I want to raise is the HR leadership also had a very strong leader who understood that they needed to have a responsibility to make sure they were looking at people capability. And that responsibility went from good times when we were looking at how to train people and prepare people and all the great stuff you do, through to, we can remember scenarios when we're, GFC is always a great one because everyone knows, but there's other times where you're in the middle of it and you don't see people responding in the way they need to. And similarly, you look at your HR, that's really the time when you suddenly drag your HR people and say, I need to do something here because I'm not getting the outcomes from the people I want in terms of the way they're managing. But look, I'm probably a bit biased on that, but I actually think it's integral. And I think I've worked with some very impressive HR people who get this. And I think if you're working with them, then they bring a lot to the table. Because at the end of the day, it's not the framework that actually does it. It's the actual people implementing the framework. If you're not confident in what they're going to do, all the policy and governance and presentations you can do to APRA and S&P and everyone else doesn't actually drive the organisation.
Just make a couple of quick comments, Ken. I think it would be disappointing if any HR team didn't review the culture it wants and take stock of where it's at. And I think, risk culture is now a term that's understood. Risk culture has profile. It's something that regulators and boards and executives understand and get. So I think the time is actually very good to engage with HR people and to have a chat with them around how we're going to explicitly assess where we are from a risk culture perspective. The other observation I'd have is that we've now got, CROs have a mandate to get involved in remuneration strategies. It's a board requirement to have a board remuneration policy. It's a board requirement to ensure that bonuses aren't excessive and can be risk adjusted and can be revised down if necessary. So I have a seat at the table now. I'm involved in determining company bonus pools, how that gets allocated, and if a functional unit head does something that's outside the risk appetite, I've got a framework for going back and saying, well, I reckon your bonus should get whacked. So the time is right, and we've got a mandate to get involved with HR, both subtly from a cultural perspective, but also from a big stick perspective.
So I'm just going to make one more comment, Melinda, because I do feel strongly about this. I do think there's an underestimation of the word management in risk management. You can set up a great risk management framework, but it doesn't stop things happening. It was interesting getting outside the GFC, and notwithstanding companies that failed, but you get outside past the GFC and people say, oh, well, we've got to go back and revisit our risk management framework because, all these things happened. We're not avoiding risk. We're taking risk. Stuff is going to happen. Something's going to hit the fan at some point. The framework isn't going to solve it. It's how the people react and manage through the situation. If you're investing in building the framework, but you're not investing in training the people and working on how they are going to behave under pressure in those situations to manage the risks in the way you want them to be managed, then, frankly, you are going to run into problems. And without getting to it, I think there are examples of organisations that failed in the GFC, which, frankly, there was a number that didn't do the preparatory work. Absolutely, they took too big exposure and there probably wasn't much they could do. There are examples of, there's one case I'm particularly thinking of, where the company really could have gone under. It wasn't the one I was working for, it was another company. And it was the way that management team responded to it and worked through those problems and worked not just with regulators but just with the balance sheet and everything else. That saved it. And that's the key differentiator. The rest is just an enabler to being in a position to do that.
Melinda House from the Institute. We have, although we're a very small business, we have a we've put in a very thorough risk management framework in the Institute because we wanted to be an example, I guess, given that actuaries are sort of forging the way in this area. So I've got a risk management framework that I think some major banks would be proud to own. But what we identified was that there was a culture, as in many businesses, of not raising incidents. And of sort of trying to sort things out yourself and not sweep it under the carpet, but you know, hide it because you know you might get whacked for actually raising it and you'd shoot the messenger. So there's nothing like changing culture in senior management than setting KPIs. So I am KPI'd around encouraging and rewarding my staff for raising incidents. And I have to show examples of where I've rewarded people and not shot them for raising incidents and issues. And I know that's not a crisis response thing, it's more a business as usual thing. But you'd be amazed how many issues, systemic issues, we've identified across the business from tracking patterns of complaints and incidents now just over the last sort of 6 months. So, yeah, KPIs are very powerful for culture.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree with that. And part of the cultural change, as well as the ownership of risk, is creating a culture of safety, where people feel safe in raising risk issues, which maybe they hadn't felt like they could do before. And in fact, we have an award scheme internally for raising risk issues, whether or not they turn out to be true issues. If it causes someone who owns that risk to have to think about it, then obviously they're not maybe on top of it as much as they should be. Unfortunately, the CRO and the CRO actually makes awards and gives out little awards to people who raise these issues. Unfortunately, the actual award itself turned out to be a fire hazard, but that was that's probably a story for a different time.
Probably time for one or two last questions.
Hi, Andrew Gower. How do you think is best to overcome the idea that management often see these measures and the various measures as coming out of black boxes? Because you've got to get them on board and happy enough and comfortable enough that they are not only the appropriate measure, but they act correctly and that they are reliable and that the models work. How do you overcome that challenge, which can be quite a big challenge? And I know I've faced challenges internally with some of that over the GFC. So,
okay, well, I'm going to sort of answer that basically by saying it goes to the heart of what we need to do as actuaries, and it's not just actuaries, as any risk management professional. A very quick story from many years ago. I was working with someone who we were doing some early work on risk-based capital. The individual was a very impressive actuary, and we were going to do one of these great big models. And in the end, this individual was brilliant, came through and did a huge exercise in about 6 weeks in putting something together. It was a fantastic piece of work. We'd go to the board. So we were putting it together and putting together the board paper, and I kid you not, we must have gone through, I can't remember now, we must have gone through 10, 15 versions of this board paper. And I remember on a Friday night, a very frustrated and exacerbated meeting, I was sitting there with this person. I was saying, look, you know, this is a fantastic piece of work. There's a huge amount of insight here into risk and how you would manage it, how you would respond to it. This paper is just, you know, people are going to get lost in the detail of it. And this actuary turned to me and said, look, Kent, that's not my job. I'm here to do the model. It's not up to me to explain what it means. I've done my piece. Now, I won't go on to how I reacted to that meeting, but to me, in my very normal patient style. To me, it goes to the heart of the problem. There was an earlier session I was just in with talking about data versus the concept of data and information come up. Whether you think you're working in risk management or not, if you're analysing risks, if you're doing this sort of analysis, you know, we do great stuff as actuaries. I think we really undersell ourselves from time to time. The reality is, it gets you halfway. We have to then, we've got to lead the horses to the water, and we've got to show them what it tastes like. Quite force them to drink, But there's a real emphasis on the professional to actually make it accessible. Now, it helps if you've got risk management professionals on boards, which is part of our risk management policy position. It helps if you've got an organisational leadership that wants to understand this stuff. But my first response to that is that's what we do as professionals. We make the stuff accessible. That's our job. And if we've got some really good solid modelling and analysis to go under that, brilliant. But the first thing is to make it accessible.
Okay, one final question. We've got 1 minute, or about half a minute by my watch.
I can think very fast. A consultant I worked with made an observation during the GFC about risk appetites and particularly target surplus. So a lot of companies will say that they want to have 90-95 some percentage confidence above regulatory capital. His observation was that there is a world of difference between being number 4 in a list of 5 people outside Ian Loughlin's office in a market event versus you've made a unit pricing error and you're the only company, or it's a fraud. My question is whether you've seen that discussed, articulated, whatever, in risk appetite statements, or is it just elephant in the room type stuff?
That's a good question, actually. I haven't seen it. I'll pass over. I haven't seen it in a risk appetite statement, but it's definitely... It definitely happens in the discussion process. I mean, that was very prevalent during the GFC, where companies were looking not just to what their absolute position was, but their relative position, because it was right at the forefront of the discussions with the regulators. But I haven't actually seen it in a policy.
Yeah, look, I think there is a moral hazard here. I think you're right. Companies, I think they don't want to be the first one into Ian Loughlin's office. But they may be happy being, you know, one of a number, or they may be happy being there with the rest of the industry. So there is a moral hazard, and I think it's sort of unavoidable at one level. One observation, though, I would have that really struck me during the financial crisis is it wasn't the target surplus policy, and it wasn't the target surplus number that was important at the end of the day. What was important was the monitoring process that went around that, and making sure you had triggers in place that made sure you got the right people in the room at the right point in time making the right decisions. So the number's just one part of the process. And I think it's less important than the actual monitoring process itself.
Yeah, I mean, the discussions around absolute versus relative were not made explicit, but you could feel that when we started talking to the board about risk appetite, we started talking about in absolute terms, and as the conversations developed, the natural safety ground was to say, well, we don't care as long as we're not as bad, worse than anyone else, which is an understandable, you know, driver of the business, but it makes it very difficult to run your business in a proactive way if all you're going to do is wait and see what everyone else does. So I don't think you can go to that purely relative view, and you do need to take some absolute stands on where you want to be.
All right. No more time for you to speak, Kent, I'm afraid. Yeah, lots of passionate debate. Just join me in the normal way in thanking John Evans, Kent Griffin, Mike Thornton. Fantastic presentation.